Welcome everyone, and thank you for joining us tonight at the Cambridge Insight Meditation Center. CIMC is a place of refuge, so we ask that you please turn off all phones and other electronics and alarms and refrain from writing or recording during the evening. Please note that there will not be a break between the talk and a short Q&A, so we ask that you stay until the end of the discussion period. All are welcome to have tea in the dining room downstairs after the program. There are hearing assistance devices at the back of the hall. At the end of this evening's talk, CIMC asks everyone to help remove the row of mats in the front and the row of mats towards the back, and then to move the chairs all the way up to the back of the seats, the back of the mats, and your assistance is very much appreciated. The following are some center updates. Doug Phillips will lead a one-day retreat titled Meditative Inquiry, Learn and Hold the Edge this Saturday, June 4th, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Please register online if you're interested. Beginning next Monday, June 6th, Lila Kate Wheeler will lead a practice group titled The Art of Walking. Class will meet Mondays from June 6th to June 27th from 7 p.m. to 8:45 p.m. Again, please register online if you're interested. And George Mumford will offer a Dharma talk titled next Wednesday, May 18th from 7:30 to 8:30. That's not the name of his talk. see the sign downstairs for the title of his talk. Beginning next Thursday, June 9th, Madeline Klein will lead a practice group titled What is Practice? Class will meet Thursdays from June 9th to June 23rd from 7 p.m. to 8:45 p.m. And again, please register online. To learn more about our upcoming programs and our schedule, please visit www.cambridgeinsight.org. Tonight, Ron Denhart is offering a Dharma talk titled Joy, Happiness, and Peace. Is there something after that?
No, I thought of all kinds of things, but I'll expand on it.
Okay, excellent. Ron has practiced insight meditation and in the Zen tradition for 25 years. He teaches the elders group and periodically teaches workshops in the beginners drop-in group here at CIMC. He also teaches meditation at colleges, adult education centers, and other community organizations. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm kind of ambivalent about, does it make sense to open the windows? The air conditioning's on, but I think it might be cooler outside. So I guess I'll just leave it. If you feel like it's kind of getting stuffy in here, feel free to open a window. It seems like the for a while when I was sitting, it felt very warm, and then the air conditioning went on, it felt pretty good, and then it warms up again. So up to you. When you paused about the title, I kind of thought that maybe you were saying, this is really strange. I thought we always talk about suffering in here. I've been talking about, since starting in December, I decided to give talks on what are usually called the Brahma Viharas, which gets translated as the Divine Abodes. Translation I prefer, the Sanskrit word is apramanya, which means the boundless qualities of the heart, something that's unlimited, because it doesn't have the cultural loading of Brahma Viharas to it. And it really is about these expansive quality of heart. And the qualities of heart that are in the Brahma Viharas or apamanya are, in the Pali, metta, karuna, mudita, and upeka. And I use the Pali words because we always get into this very messy problem of translation. So metta gets translated as loving kindness by some people, by kindness by other people who don't want to get the loving stuff in there, goodwill, and if you're really having a hard time, non-aversion. I send you all my non-aversion, you know. And then, again, karuna is usually translated as compassion, but again, that's gets to be a little problematic because compassion comes from the Greek, passion is to suffer, And come means to suffer with. And really, it doesn't mean that. It means to care for, to want to help someone who's in pain, but still not to lose your ground, because you really can't help others if you're suffering with them. You know, you're actually kind of pulling them down in a sense. And then mudita, is usually translated as appreciative joy or sympathetic joy. That's what I'm going to talk about this evening. And then upeka, which is usually translated as equanimity, kind of means even mind. You could think of it as something balanced, spaciousness, that sort of thing. When I thought about this talk, usually joy gets talked about in terms of these Brahmaviharas or Upamanyas as this kind of joy we have in the happiness of others. But that's really a very limited use of the word. And joy, just if you go through discourses, it's all over the place. And in fact, if you go through discourses, words like joy, happiness, bliss, ecstasy, peace, calm, let me see if I missed a few here, pleasure, ease, satisfaction, contentment. They're all, the Pali words that translate into this are all through the discourses. And, you know, it just seems kind of strange, you know, in some ways, because usually the four ennobling truths are, there is dukkha, which usually gets translated as suffering, but it's actually a very subtle word. It means, can be translated as suffering, stress, that things are inherently unsatisfactory. But it's very subtle. Actually, the most subtle definition of dukkha is a sense of someone outside the experience, a sense of me. This is all happening too. So if you're kind of ring your thought process a little bit. I took a walk with a friend today around a pond, and I said, you know, some of this stuff seems so obvious now, the idea that there's a self that all this is happening to. But when you really think about it, where is it? What is constant? It's kind of a fabrication of the mind. And even when we see it, it's still, you know, kind of manifest itself. You know, it's not, you're free from it when you kind of say, oh, well, it's just, you know, something the mind creates, a sense of me. You know, it could seem kind of superficial to talk about these qualities of heart. I mean, let's get into the really serious stuff, you know, suffering, its end, its cause and its end, and the path to the end of it. That's the Four Ennobling Truths. So I want to be very clear here that because I'm talking about uplifting qualities this evening, I don't mean in any way to use them as a way to gloss over difficulties. Okay, they really, really do have to meet our difficulties and open to them. And you know, some of the other qualities of Brahmaviharas, like compassion, equanimity, are ways to do that. And these qualities of heart actually support each other. So you have, you know, equanimity, to have a sense of evenness, of spaciousness, to be able to hold things, allows compassion. If you're, you know, lost in aversion and fear and all that sort of thing, you really can't help someone else. And actually metta, loving kindness or you know, goodwill, is a cause for joy. So you know, they kind of shade into each other. And they reinforce them, and you know, and sometimes I think they just manifest naturally, and sometimes I mean, one way to kind of look at these things is that we're trying to cultivate when we're doing Brahmaviharas or Upamanyas. I think I'm just going to use Upamanya the rest of this evening. What we're doing these, the standard practice is to repeat these phrases over and over again. And the idea behind it is to form an intention. It's not that you expect to fix people or yourself or anything else. It's just, it's trying to form an intention to be kind, compassionate, to have joy, and to be equanimous. And you could sort of say, well, my reaction to this stuff when I first started practicing, well, this is all just conditioning. You know, it seems superficial. And yet, if you ask the Dalai Lama what he thought was more important, seeing through the sense of self and seeing emptiness, or these qualities of heart, he would tell you these qualities of heart. If you ask Nagarjuna, who's one of the most profound contributors of Buddhist understanding, he would say the same thing. John Peacock said these qualities of heart are the most important part of the Buddhist teaching. And they're actually a manifestation that when you see through the sense of self, through the sense of separation, then they're the natural manifestation. So we can kind of see like, oh, emptiness, not self, nothing matters. That's not really emptiness. That's some idea, some concept. But when you really see it deeply, you see this, when you drop away the sense of identity, there's a sense of connection, of non-separation with each other, and these qualities manifest. So now that I've totally deviated from my whole planned talk, which I usually do, which is always kind of a fascinating thing, it's a really good way to see not self. You know, it's sort of like a layout, these ideas about what I'm going to talk about. And as I was joking, my son, who's pretty far along, amazingly far along for a 23-year-old, I don't know what will come out. It just kind of flows through. It's not like there's someone doing, giving this talk. So if it's poor talk, not my fault. Well, on the other hand, if it's a good talk, I don't get credit for it either, okay? So, you know, the idea that it's conditioned and it might seem superficial is we are conditioned. I don't know if anybody saw the movie The Knight's Tale. It's kind of a spoof. It's about this really evil knight who, of course, wears black and does all these terrible things. And there's a tournament, and a jousting tournament where they're riding on the horses of these, I don't know what, lances, is that what they call them? I don't know. And so the evil knight does some terrible things and cheats and all that, but he still loses. And at the end of the movie, he's lying on the ground, and his three adversaries, one is the person who fought him, and the other two are the person who supports the person who fight him, the good knight. They look down on him and they say, "You've been weighed, measured, and found wanting." And interestingly, I didn't know this, but that quote actually comes from Daniel, a book in the Bible that God is telling someone. I don't know if it's all of humanity or a particular group of humanity, but they've been weighed, measured, and found wanting. And the most pervasive cause for unhappiness that I've come across through my teaching is a sense that we are wanting, that we are not adequate. Anybody have an inner critic sort of criticize themselves? Or, you know, I mean, it just, and I lead an elders group, and this woman at one time, she says, I'm 81 years old, and I thought by the time I was 80, my father would be off my shoulder. Okay. And you know, we're just conditioned. I mean, advertising tells us how we should look. We're told we get weighed and measured in the school system. You get weighed and measured when you get up here and give a talk. You get weighed and measured at work. You know, it's just pervasive about all these messages we get from advertising about what we should be. And if we are those things, then we'll be happy. Ajahn Sucitto kind of posed a really great question. Madeline Klein and I ran a workshop on the inner critic or something like that. I don't know what we called it. And Ajahn, we had this question. We had this group, each people break up into groups and discuss this question, which was, what will make you enough, and when will you be enough? They kind of, some of them came back and said, this is a trick question. You know, but it is. So a lot of this practice is, you could view it as conditioning, But you also could view it as a way of directing your attention to what's already there. And, you know, we're wired to focus on the negative. I listened to a talk by someone at Harvard that said, anytime you say something bad to someone, like maybe you make some stupid remark or maybe it's even an appropriate remark, I don't know, you have to say something good 5 times to make up for it. We take in the negative. Okay? So what we're going to do is direct our attention to things up to that uplift the heart. We can actually do that. We can refocus where we direct our attention and what kind of perceptions we form about things, how we see the world. And I don't mean in the sense of Pollyannish type sense, but in part it's kind of to challenge our habitual ways of meeting things, which are also perceptions we've learned to form and also places we learn to direct our attention. And to do that, really want to, and this is true not just for developing joy or these qualities of apramanya, but for all of our practice, we want to bring a quality of what Ajahn Sucitto refers to as holistic awareness. And by that, I mean that you kind of think of us ourselves as having, this is a nice little model, is this cognitive aspect, this thinking, planning, organizing part. That's one of the parts of holistic awareness. And some people really tend to be up in the head, which is the place that causes most of the trouble. That's where all the judgment, da-da-das, comes from. Another aspect is this heart quality, just this felt sense of things. How are we affected by what we do, what we think? And then the third is the body. So really, to kind of see what attention, what perceptions we have that are uplifting, we really need to pay attention to how does the heart feel when I do this? How does the body feel? Ajahn Sucitto has this wonderful line, and I'm going to miss it now. We run around like a head on wheels. You know, we just sometimes it's totally detached from the body. And there's a really wonderful quote that in one part of the Pali text that the Buddha talks about touching enlightenment. He's actually talking about an embodied experience. So when you're sitting, whatever you're doing, don't just be up here watching the mind. You want to feel this whole sense of what you are. So I just want to read a little piece from a discourse on these boundless qualities of heart. And this particular language I'm reading has to do with metta, but you could substitute in joy if you know, whatever, any one of these qualities of heart you could substitute in. One suffuses the world in 4 directions with a mind of benevolence. So you're sending kindness in all 4 directions. Then above and below and all around, the whole world from all sides, completely with a benevolent, all-embracing, great, boundless, peaceful, and friendly mind. Just as a powerful conch blower makes himself heard with no great effort in all 4 directions, so too there is no limit to the unfolding of this heart-liberating benevolence. So the idea in all these qualities of heart is to gradually expand them so we can include everything in them. And when we do that, actually the sense of self weakens. And probably, I have a friend who has done every one of these for 2 months. And she said, you know, basically the sense of someone loving or having joy just disappears. There's nothing but love, nothing but joy, which is this non-separation I referred to in the beginning. Actually, a sense of identity disappears. Okay. So maybe I'll just offer, and the particular phrases that you use are something that just resonates for you. So here's a particular set of phrases from Appreciative Joy. How wonderful you are in your being. I delight that you are here. I take joy in your good feeling. May your happiness continue. And I don't know, I mean, if you just think about actually meeting people like that, it's uplifting, right? It's uplifting for both you and the person you're doing it for. The Dalai Lama once said, I meet everyone like they're an old friend. And it's kind of contagious, really. And it doesn't belong to anyone. Now, mudita is probably the hardest practice there is to do, because it's the one practice where you really don't do it for yourself. It's kind of really the ultimate not self-referencing. Now, in a way, I can think that you could do it for yourself. If you think about parts of you that you really take joy in, that you really appreciate, then you could say, oh, you know, how wonderful you are, this part of you that's got this wonderful connected heart. Right? Just appreciate that. I was talking to my son this evening about, you know, all these kind of unpleasant thoughts that come on, maybe jealousy or some sort of irritation, or I want things to be other way. And there's a great way to meet that. I really like to meet that is you just say, oh, hi, how are you? I haven't seen you for about 5 minutes. It's a nice way to deal with the inner critic, actually. You know, just because you really don't want to push these things away. You want to open to them. So the reason I gave the title I gave, Joy, Happiness, and Peace, and I probably should have, I mean, if I've been tried to be more precise, I would probably put joy, happiness, and equanimity. But I don't know, for some reason I wasn't in the mood to do that. And someone canceled out at the last minute, so that's what it was. They're really the qualities of the jhanas, these states of absorption, these deep states of absorption that one gets created. Those are some of the translations of the second, third, and fourth jhana. So piti is sometimes translated as joy. Sukha is sometimes translated as often translated as happiness, and equanimity, well, is just translated. I mean, upeka gets translated as equanimity, and they do have these qualities of kind of a turning down the voltage, I guess. So in these particular absorptions. Joy has kind of got a lot of energy to it. And when I actually first learned to do these absorptions, my teacher said, okay, you do this, you learn joy, and you learn to ramp it up and control it, you know. And you might think that's really great, joy, rapture, da-da, bliss. But after a while, you're doing that for a week, it's really not. It's too much excitement in it. So the instructions for the second jhana, or third jhana, is to drop down, a sense of contentment, like you feel like you could be here forever. And equanimity is very subtle because it's there really isn't a pleasant or unpleasant quality to it, but there's something subtle that's really nicer than any of them. And it's I don't know how to describe it. So when I use these words, joy and happiness, they can convey all kinds of things. And there's a book called Stumbling on Happiness by, I think it's Dan Gilbert, where he just discusses the problem of describing whether someone's happy or not. How do you know? It's a subjective sense. He actually gives an example. If you're trying to tell an alien what yellow is, and you point to a bus and a couple other things that are yellow, the alien still doesn't know what yellow is. He might be like, what? You know. There's I think it's worth pondering yourself, and And John Stuart Mill once said that I'd rather be a discontented human being than a contented pig, or I'd rather be a Socrates than a fool that's contented. So it kind of raises some other questions about, well, what do we mean? Are we talking about, I mean, you could have a pleasurable feeling by having, I don't know, opium or, you know, getting smashed or whatever, but it doesn't last and it doesn't do a whole lot for society. So these are kind of some issues about this whole notion of joy and appreciation. There's a guy named George I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, Violent. He was a psychiatrist at Harvard, and he did this longitudinal study, which basically means you follow people all through their lives. And he followed Harvard sophomores from that year until the present, many of which are dead now, and just did all these questionnaires about what they were happy and what caused happiness and all that sort of thing. JFK was in that study, by the way. And one thing I found out that he was actually quite ill. I didn't know that. It was hidden quite a bit. At any rate, he describes happiness as something that's cognitive. That's sort of this up here part. Now, this is just his, don't worry so much about the language, but just the idea that it's something in the parasympathetic nervous system. And the parasympathetic nervous system drives the freeze, flight, or fight, freeze, fight, freeze, or flee response. It's not really kind of a great sort of thing you really want. So what he talks about is that joy stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the system that is kind of a rest and digest system. Okay. So he makes this quote: "We can laugh from either joy or happiness, but we weep only from grief or joy. Happiness displaces pain, but joy embraces it." So putting aside the language of happiness versus joy, he's talking about this open quality of heart, which is what all these practices of the Aparamanyas are about, is to open our heart. And to have real joy, we also have to be willing to open to the difficulty, to the sorrow. And actually, in a way, what he talks about cognitive is a lot of practice is kind of seeing through this veil of thought that separates us from our experience. Because we tend to go up in the head because we don't want to feel things. So I want to acknowledge that some people can't feel joy or can't conceive of being in joy. And so I want to try a little practice here. I'm rapidly chewing up my time. Wow. There's a guy named Rick Hansen who's a neuroscientist, and he has this acronym HEAL, which is to have a good experience, enhance it, absorb it, and the L is optional, which is to link it, to bring up something that's unpleasant after you're feeling really good. And what he argues is basically it overwrites the memory system. Okay. As I think about the Buddhist practice, much of it is about generating a good sense of self, a good set of programs. You know, when we meditate, believe it or not, the idea is to create a sense of ease, of welcoming, of, you know, being at peace. And the same thing is true of integrity, cultivating these qualities? Is it creating a healthy enough sense of self or self a set of programs that we can then open to the difficult and to see through the sense of self? So, you know, what Rick Hansen is talking about, and he certainly practices the Buddhist tradition, is very consistent with that. So the idea is to have a good experience, to actually actively look for uplifting experiences. And then to really take them in. So these can be really simple things like you open the door for someone and just notice how it feels when you do that. You know, when you have the intention to do it, when you actually are in the process of doing it and afterwards. Just saying something kind to someone or someone says something kind to you. If you actually, rather than just sort of letting it float by, just start turning your attention to that all the time. I actually had an experience, not the only time I've ever done an act of kindness, but for some reason it really has struck me, is I was at Whole Foods one time, and this woman who was quite elderly, her hands were shaking and her, you know, she had bad teeth, and she asked me if I would read the date on the milk carton for her. It's a very simple thing. And I did that and suggested some other milk that had a later expiration date. And there was just this connection. And a lot of happiness is really about that, just really connecting. And I was amazed at how good it felt afterwards. And it's not like I was a compassionate, kind person. It was just this action took place that was uplifting. And so it's just starting to look for these things. So I want to just play with this a little bit. And what I have to say, we're unfortunately not going to be able to spend a lot of time on this because I'm really running over already. It is what I'm going to suggest a little practice now is that I'm going to have to rush through it because we don't have a lot of time, but it's actually on the homework for the elders group. So if you want to kind of look at it later, it's something I had them do because I've been trying to get them to do joy rather than talking about how their bodies are falling apart. And someone told me they must hate you. but actually, some of them are doing it. Okay. So let's start with one way to activate the parasympathetic nervous system is diaphragmatic breathing. And this is actually the way that the healthy way to breathe. So diaphragmatic breathing is to allow the diaphragm to drive the breathing process rather than, you know, forcing the breath in. So if you notice, the diaphragm is a muscle down here underneath the rib cage, and it pushes down, contracts on the in-breath, so it pushes down and actually makes the lungs bigger, and then the air pressure in the lungs drops by a tiny amount. This is really amazing. I mean, this is a way to kind of see joy in a sense, is how amazing this universe is, that this works. I mean, how did this happen? You know, there's something, this muscle moves down, lowers the air pressure in the chest below what the outside air pressure is, air flows in, and then it relaxes, and the pressure in the chest increases, and the air goes out. So just the way diaphragmatic breathing goes is just maybe we'll take a few deeper breaths, but this is something you would just do in a normal breathing process. So I'm not trying to say that you should do deep breathing all the time, but just to get a sense of what it feels like. If you put your hand on your chest, so the chest shouldn't move a whole lot. Okay, up a little higher. So mostly, you kind of notice the belly kind of expanding on the in-breath and dropping down the out-breath. And my teacher used to say the key to good meditation was just letting the belly drop into the lap. Now she's saying letting the diaphragm completely relax. So it's the same thing. So just take some breathe in through the nose. And notice how the belly expands on the in-breath, and drops down on the out breath. Or you can pay attention to the diaphragm contracting, pushing down on the in breath, and relaxing on the out breath. And you can actually even imagine going into a deeper state of relaxation with each out breath. So really dropping down like you're going down an elevator. And you can soften your eyes and your lips. And you might think about something uplifting. Give your aspirations for this practice, or something kind you've done today, or something kind that's happened to you. It might be something really simple, like someone letting you out of traffic. Or the miracle is being breathed by this body. You might even bring a slight smile to your face, to your lips. And then bring your attention to your heart. You might even, if you want, put your hand over your heart. And just in a very open, light way, pay attention to how the heart sense feels. If there's any difficult emotion, you can bring some care and interest and a quality of allowing to it. And if there's any sense of an unpleasant feeling tone, let's see if you can just bring a caring, interested attention to it. Just allow that to be there. And if it's overwhelming, you can bring your attention to areas that feel okay. So staying connected with it, but having quality of spaciousness. You might pay attention to sounds or to space around you. So this CIA, caring, interest, and allow. And what you might find if you do this on your own and with more time, that the sense of aversion, of unpleasantness, might fade. And there might be a quiet joy just from the absence of the aversion to it. And so when you're ready, just open your eyes and we'll move back into the talk. So this is kind of, you know, aspects of these qualities of heart. You know, there's this notion of spaciousness, so you can hold it and kind of bring kind of some compassion to it, some caring interest, just allowing it. It's part of equanimity. And, you know, over time, if the aversion fades, which aversion is, you know, non-aversion is a form of loving kindness or metta, then there's a sense of joy about it. So it's sort of some sense of how they reinforce each other and how to explore them. So some people might, I'm going to skip over a lot of things I was going to say tonight because I'm running out of time, but some people might object to joy as it's impermanent. But it is impermanent. All these qualities are impermanent. Everything's impermanent. But we can nurture it. And Ajahn Tanisaro, who's translated most of the Pali text, says that it's kind of like climbing a ladder, that we really have to I'll be careful about, yeah, well, I don't know what he actually sort of says. It's like climbing a ladder. You have to hold on to one rung until you get to the next one. And so a lot of practices actually develop these uplifting qualities so that we can start, you know, at some point, then we can start letting them go. But it really, you know, there is this part of practice is very much about developing certain qualities that allow us to go to the next step. So joy supports equanimity. You know, if you don't need so much, then you're more equanimous because you're not running around trying, I got to have this, kind of to be happy. In a way, unhappiness is a habit. And it seems natural. It's just, this is who I am. And it actually takes a fair amount of effort to be unhappy. I mean, you just think about all the thoughts you have, I'm not saying anybody in particular here, but all the thoughts, all the views, opinions, all that sort of thing, about how life should be, how it's not the way it's supposed to be. It's a particular perception, a way of seeing the world. So, you know, it's really helpful to say, is joy really possible for me? You know, we can ask what blocks joy. This little inner critic, right? You should be this, you should do this, you should accomplish this. If I get this, I'll be happy. There's a concept called hedonic adaptation, which basically, when we get something, then you get used to that, and then you think, oh, well, now I need more. It just doesn't, you know, this is craving. This is what the Buddha calls the cause of suffering. Always trying to get somewhere because that'll make me feel better. And the Buddha's saying, well, no, that's what keeps you from being happy. It's learning to really open to meet this moment. Can we find joy in this moment? But we get all these advertisements that we, you know, all these things we should do, and we're actually conditioned that we need to get all these things to be happy. There's actually a part of the brain that creates this wanting function, and it's useful in a lot of ways. It's driven by some of it's driven by biological wiring, having sex, you know, procreation, and obvious things like food, water. We need them, but there's also a form of craving that's because, oh, I had this pleasant experience, so if I do this, I'll get it. That's a kind of conditioning. And then there's this pervasive advertising type sort of thing. We've been conditioned to think this is what we need to be happy. Okay. So I want to maybe just talk about, boy, I'm skipping over a lot of stuff here. Some ways that we can cultivate joy. gratitude. Just thinking of the things that you have, the things that are okay, because the craving is all about things you think you don't have and you need to be happy. When I first got exposed to gratitude, it was from a friend who said, I'm thankful I have clean underwear. You know, but it's amazing what we have, right? I mean, we have a place to sleep at night. We have food. You know, we've got this wonderful place where we're all sitting here trying to connect and grow. I mean, just take it on. There's a book called Tidying Up, which was written by a Japanese woman. And basically she says to go through everything you own, and if it doesn't bring you joy, throw it out. And she has this very systematic way of doing it, where like you go through all your clothes and you go through. Now, for me, I couldn't go through a drawer, much less go through all my clothes or all through my whatever else. But the idea of looking at things you have and allowing that to bring you joy, you know, a coffee pot a cup, I mean, just actually just looking at all these things. Isn't this miracle? I have clothes to wear in the morning, at night, you know. I have a bed to sleep in. So you start looking to things you have and just appreciate them. She actually says, I think you bow to them. Okay. I've talked about metta and compassion, actually seeing when we act, perform acts of kindness and caring. Compassion actually is uplifting. It's when there's aversion that things shouldn't be here that causes the heaviness. So if compassion doesn't feel uplifting, see what you think shouldn't be happening. You're trying to fix things, probably. Good friendship. You know, hang around people who are happy. It's contagious. I talked to some teacher. He said, some friend called, and he asked how she's doing. She said, I'm doing wonderful. And then he just started feeling that way. Just being around people like that's uplifting. Biophilia. That sounds like something kinky, doesn't it? It's love of nature. I mean, I just walk in here this evening and there's these beautiful purple flowers, and you know, if you just open yourself to that and really. So a lot of this is getting out of the sense of self, because the sense of self is contracted. So when you're really appreciating nature, without now this one's not probably very popular, but renunciation. Narayan kind of jokes that she's going to give a talk called The Secret something, Secret Message or something, because renunciation is not kind of very appealing. But it's simplifying her life, not needing so much, not needing to do so much, simply moving slowly. I realize how I picked up my pace here because I'm running way over. It is that just if you don't have so many things to do, and you do what you do in a nice, slow, easeful way, it creates a sense of joy rather than trying to get all these things. Here's another one that people probably aren't too wild about. Contemplating the characteristics of life. Now, what are the three characteristics? This is, you know, supposedly what part of insight meditation is about, is seeing that all things are impermanent, not self, and unsatisfactory. Now, that doesn't sound too cheery, actually. Ajahn Tanisaro actually languages in a different way, which I prefer. He's the only person I know who does this. Everybody else talks about this is the three characteristics of existence. He talks about them as perceptions. Skillful perceptions. So there's a guy who was in my elders group who had a heart attack, and it was a mild heart attack, so he drove himself to the hospital, and the surgeon said, do you know you're having a heart attack? And he said, who's having a heart attack? Because it's a not self-teaching. Skillful perception. This is not my body. And he really talked about how he had a sense of lightness about this. So you can have sometimes it's good to have a sense of self, sometimes it's not. You know, if you don't have any control over it, that's not you. So emotions, I'm angry. Well, did you choose to be angry? Did you choose to be irritated? That if you see it in that self, you don't contract around it so much. So actually, you know, these qualities, and I really like the perception interpretation of choosing perceptions that are uplifting. That, you know, if things are really unpleasant, knowing is impermanent is kind of nice, right? You're in a dental chair. Well, I'm not going to be here the rest of my life. But it also helps you not chase after things. If I get this, I'll really be happy, because you know that's not the truth. What we don't see is that the craving has an energy to it. It creates a form of stress trying to get these things. You're not really present. You know, just meeting everything with beginner's mind, like we've never seen each other before, and not just seeing the detailed expressions on each other's faces, really opening up, kind of a sense of real curiosity. One of my favorites was this came from another tradition, but it's a woman talked about what she called unprovoked happiness, and it really is kind of what I've been talking about just really opening up to the vividness, to seeing things like an artist. And she described, like, she looked at a pile of laundry, and rather than just seeing it as a pile of laundry, notice that it's got different textures, it's got colors to it, it's piled in a particular way. I've been taking that on. I look at the table, and you can say, oh, it's all cluttered. But it's actually a particular kind of clutter. I walk around this pond quite often, and there's a bridge that goes across this stream. And when I go across, there's these birds are singing, there's these nice little currents, and the sun's shining off of it. I call it the bridge of unprovoked happiness. And you can actually start creating little cues like this for yourself. To always find things to turn, not always, but you know, when you can, to start directing your attention more and more to what's uplifting. The Buddha said, whatever one frequently dwells upon, that will be the inclinations of the heart and mind. So if you frequently dwell upon all the things that make you unhappy, that's the inclination of heart and mind. If you dwell upon things that make you happy, feel joyful, that will be the inclination of heart and mind. So yes, it's kind of you could call it a programming. But it's really about, where are we going to focus our attention? How do we perceive things? How do we interpret them? And you know, it's also an investigation to see what you actually do. You know, so another way to look at all this is rather than you're cultivating or developing, that you're investigating, seeing what blocks these qualities. What blocks joy? Comparing mind, greedy mind, angry mind. I'm sure you can put a list. You investigate it for yourself. So I kind of leave you with maybe two thoughts. Ask yourself what it would be like to experience a half hour of joy every day. How would that change your life? Now, I don't mean to sit down for a half hour and try and be joyful, but just, you know, separate, you know, various moments, just to find what can be uplifting. I've been doing this for a couple of months. I've been doing each one of these Brahma Viharas for a couple of months because I was going to give talks on them, but I give talks on them is to take them on. And, you know, I came into the center and was talking to some of the staff, and I told them what I was doing. They said, you can just see it through you. It really can change yourself, amazingly. And realize it's all impermanent. The greatest freedom, the greatest happiness is to be free of all these conditions. But this is the path to get to there. Okay? All right, so I'm going to stop there. I skipped all kinds of material I would love to talk about. But just open it up to questions. And if you want to talk about suffering, stress, how horrible your life is, that's fine as well.